We all tell ourselves stories of who we are and why. But we forget that we have the power to define them. That no idea grows from mewling striped cub to teeth at your throat tiger without a little help, some guidance, and a whole lot of love along the way. I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers. Hi, all, I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers, your storytelling guide. Here with me today is...
It's me, Ken. I've known Jared for a million years. Sometimes I show up here.
You have your ice cream?
I do.
Awesome. That'll be our official inspiration follower for the episode. So, Dave and I, last episode, were talking about ways to take a premise from the moment of big upheaval, whether you lay out the everyday first and then go to the moment of the great change, whether you lay out the great change and then in the moment surrounding that or after reveal what is different now and how and why, to what extent, or whether you let it be somewhere far down the ways and we just live in the change space and discover the upheaval later. This is the second part now, and Ken is joining us for, I think, one of his favorite narrative beats.
Moment when problems happen. Problems are important.
They are, because otherwise you end up with a conversation I have heard at least five times, starting from my writing tenure in college down to, I think, watching Brian Cox. He was an adaptation. He was performing some famous writing coach. Mm. And Nicolas Cage, was it? No, it was Nicolas Cage, yeah. Plays one of two writers who are siblings. Famously asked him, what if I want a story where, you know, nothing happens and nothing changes? And you can look up the tarot online, but Cox tears him a new one. Mm. The same way that I had a compatriot in my writing program back in, I want to say sophomore year, who said, yes, this entire story is about Bethany across the table from the dog catcher and how they have a conversation. But importantly, nothing happens and nothing changes.
It better be a hell of an interesting conversation then.
Apparently, he wanted to date her, but she was mad that he couldn't actually catch dogs because he found the whole enterprise boring.
So, no. And now I feel bad that we're tearing down some random classmate of yours, but
I don't bring it up to tear him down, but to Brian Cox's point, what he said in that tirade was, are you seriously going to tell me that in every moment of every day, somebody's life isn't being forever changed in a big or little way? That there is no conflict anywhere at all, ever.
Okay.
Where the stakes don't matter. And I think the thing that made that story memorable and boring to me and to you to hear is that he never got to the point in the exploration of it where we understood why they were sitting down and having this conversation. We simply had the surface, the stuff that was presumably every day that should have been, through the exploration of it, revealing what now has changed, the why now. Part of what precipitated this conversation with Dave was that I was reading and watching shows and wondering why they couldn't, in many cases, just cut out the first episode or two or first two chapters and begin with the moment where things matter.
Well, A, TV executives are cowards. So let's get that out of the way. Right. They think that people are too dumb to grab hold of a show where things just start happening. Mm-hmm.
I think I read a book recently where it felt quite like someone had told the author, no, you need five paragraphs in front of your introduction to lay out all the parameters. Mm-hmm. Because the actual introduction is the parade through the city as the king has died and how different people view that in the moment. And that lays out the spirit and
that
the heart.
Seems
of
like
character.
A very strong start.
Right. Like, king is dead, city's changed forever. Here's what people think, down to big and little, important or not, wealthy, poor, you know, across the whole spectrum in life of the city. Whereas the first five opening paragraphs go into this weird, nebulous set of abstracts about a city that is a city with walls that aren't walls, that contain but don't contain.
Cool.
And, you know, like all of those might be thematic elements to the story, but
you can't get away with that now that we're no longer writing for like pulp magazines and like weird tales and stuff.
Right. And I know you and I differ on this, but one of my bugaboos with fiction is the preface that is a letter by someone fictional in the story to the reader about the story they're about to encounter and how wonderful it is?
I mean, it depends.
Okay. I'm waiting for your ice cream wisdom.
So it's a staple of a lot of older weird fiction to be like, oh, this is a strange thing and a tale I will now tell you of my friend who went on a sojourn to a foreign country and came back forever changed and things like that at the front, so that you know that the narrator is not necessarily the person to whom this is happening.
Right.
It lets you establish a tone and a style.
That was a more common narrative technique in the past, to have a narrator who was not the focal point of the story.
Right. Like, I've been reading Clark Ashton Smith this last week, and he was one of many writers of that era and genre who was perfectly happy to use that premise. You know, this is a story I am telling you that I kind of blundered into the middle of. It's a very common premise, or not premise, starting point, let's go with, for a lot of that kind of thing. And it works. It's functional.
But it still answers the why now. Why does the tale begin in this moment and why is it happening?
Right. Well, that's the best part about it, really, is that it saves the writer a lot of work. You know why this is important. The narrator is telling you it's important. And they're telling you, oh, well, you need to hear this right up front. It's almost an effort to hijack, you know, the conversation into a literary form.
If I'm not mistaken, Don Quixote begins in a similar fashion.
I don't remember. I think you are probably right.
The crazy thing about that is it has periods where Cervantes is railing against other people who've stolen his character.
And yes.
I've told the story wrong, which is delightful, but also madness.
Well, it's something that could really only exist in the literary environment that didn't exist when he wrote it.
which is part of why it has its own weird kudzu structure.
Right.
But it does begin, I think, infamously with a moment of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza differing on what is real and not. So you are quickly laid into, even though someone else is narrating this.
Right.
Here is the story's heart, right here.
One way or another, this is about whether imagination is more important than reality.
Right. Or I think, as it's said, laid out in the musical version of it, which is brutal, I think in the moment where Don Quixote encounters the enchanter and he confronts him with the mirrors of reality, and Don Quixote famously shouts, "Facts are the enemies of truth." Because
it's a great line, if nothing else.
It's Don Quixote's entire narrative as a statement, as a belief.
More or less, so, yeah.
I think we can look at this narrative technique and see if it applies to the attempt we're going to take today, which is to revisit our space tourist and fantasy line, this time not with the what ifs that led to the crash or the moment the ship decided, you know what, I'm done with this, etc. But what if we just begin with the problem?
Okay. So you have multiple potential problems identified in what you and Dave were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There's the very obvious one, which is that the ship has skived off from its job and people would like to leave.
Right.
Okay. So that's certainly one thing. But the reality is that's not a good problem for anything other than a fairly narrow and cursory exploration of your fantasy space, because nobody will care what's going on in the fantasy space. It's just a matter of where did the computer go?
It's a Planet of Hats episode at that point.
Right. And that's fine.
Sure.
But it doesn't really serve what you're trying to do here.
Right. It's not the beginning of a longer piece. That is a set piece or a contained story in itself.
Right. So that can't be your kickoff problem. It can be kind of an overarching theme where, you know, okay, fine, we're in these circumstances. How do we fit into them? Which I think also helps with your alleged villain, who doesn't even sound especially villainous, quite frankly, the way you guys describe him.
But again, I think that comes back to the moment of narrative, because it comes down to how he's presented and described.
Mm-hmm.
I know you had a very different read on him, which is part of why I think this will be interesting.
I did, but primarily because of how you described it in shorthand. When I listened to you and Dave talking about it, it does not emerge as some kind of, like, horrible pain in the ass person who we can only make a villain anymore. It emerges as somebody who, for one reason or another, never had a chance to shine and is really sure they can now, for better or worse. And it can be either.
I encounter this often. We find the awesome villains, right? And I know you and I have been itching to do a villain episode forever, but there is a place for the pitiful antagonist.
This guy doesn't even necessarily have to be an antagonist. Like, I hate to say it, but if we were going to write something using the fundamental principles of, like, AAA video games,
sure,
that's the guy giving you all your quests.
Right. And I think this goes back to your point of saying, your moment of saying, I, as the narrator or character, would love to be the butler to this type of person, because that's the more interesting story.
Specifically as the character. Like, how do you make this asshole happy? That's interesting. That's a fun sort of in-game dynamic.
Particularly when he causes problems for everyone else, too, either by what he demands or has gotten you into.
Right. And then you have to make excuses for it. Again, like, that's going to be more fun in a lot of ways for me.
Because I think that lends into what Dave and I were talking toward the latter third of the previous episode, where there comes a point where do we try to keep the kayfabe running? You know, is it safer for everybody involved if we all pretend this is just pure tourism from afar?
Well, so I think you set a trap for yourselves and were too clever also with your, well, what if everybody shows up at this giant golem head all at once and nobody realizes that these guys are from somewhere else immediately?
We wrote, I think, off of that particular truth. It doesn't have to remain that way particularly.
You wrote a really long way off of that jump off point.
Right.
And into some really weird places.
It is in part modeling how we try to, I think, by through access, show people that it is possible to take a point and run with it rather than being afraid of where it might lead you. But right, for the pacing exercise, I think we should see how many of those truths remain pertinent to this iteration, and then decide, as you've said, what the problem should be. Because the ship deciding to bug off, that's a persistent issue. But that's not the big moment.
That's not a good problem. Exactly. So some other problems occurred to me that were, you know, emergent from you guys' narrative. Rather than immediately introduce the look, you have two ways you can go about this. All right. But it's essentially the same trick. Either the characters in the game are the locals stumbling upon these people, and then you have an immediate problem. What is this nonsense? Okay. Now, fundamentally, there are some role-playing game stories that are about encountering a big personality and their minions. Usually they live in a dungeon and you beat them up and take their stuff, but not always.
Ship from outer space would qualify for that, certainly.
But you could frame that way. It would be a little lazy, but you could do it. It's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially you're playing Palace of the Silver Princess at that point, but it's okay.
True.
The much more interesting problem, I think, is as the crew, the main crew, not the passengers, all right, of the spaceship, the moment when you realize, oh, there are people who live here and we're going to have to explain ourselves to them, is a good problem.
I think, yeah, it kind of goes back to one of the smaller moments Dave and I discussed before of, okay, well, who are the characters who would be point of view in this moment? Would it be the event planner, the manager, the porters, the folks who are trying to maintain normalcy while they figure out how long this is going to remain a thing?
So I think fundamentally what you want to start from is the ship is down.
Sure.
Okay. The space people are off the ship and they need to figure out what's going on around here.
So we've had our disembarkation. There's the moment where we've managed to get everyone safely off the ship, make it seem like it's the normal routine thing.
Right. And then, okay, rather than go, oh no, the computer's not around. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You go, well, now what do we do? You play it as if it was a completely normal incident, because that's what the bridge crew, as it were, is going to want to do here.
So effectively, you're setting up the kayfabe tension, the masquerade, from the beginning.
Right.
Our tension here is maintaining that this is a purely standard fair
moment. It's a scheduled landing. We meant to be here. Go look at that big thing.
So that means there's going to have to be, I think, by the major characters involved, an itinerary that they either had to search out and plot out beforehand involving scouting and whatnot, or they're just eyeballing what the scanner said and said, hey, that looks okay.
Right. So what you're going to do, presumably, is face the bridge crew. I'm going to keep using that term, I think. It's just better from my perspective.
Okay.
With the problem of identifying what they can use in this, I don't know, are we in a jungle, forest? What are we in?
I just had a moment of a game, and we've mentioned this before, but where we all turned to you and said, Ken, which part of the green part's on the map?
Uh-huh.
But that fundamentally is the question here,
right,
as the players would be asking the computer.
Right. And the problem is that and so you can face them with the larger problem of the computer is not around by telling them the computer is not answering you. Also, several things don't work. This is weird.
Right.
But you still have to entertain these people. You can't stop everything. Well, you figure that out.
You can give some, as we mentioned before, all fantasy lands have weird magic space realms around them. So interference in the space magical techno realm, you know, of things that make the computer busy or inoperable or tired or sleepy or busy.
Right. And you can pull back the curtain on that as quickly or as fast as you'd like. It's okay.
But the reason I bring it up is that, like, the only thing the crew has to tell the tourists is there are particulars to this world that prevent certain systems from working at full capacity. So here are
our... They don't have to tell them anything, provided that the drinks keep coming.
Well, okay. And this is where we get to smaller problems within the big problem, right? Mm-hmm. Because how much of what they would need to make to grease the wheels to keep the machine running smoothly stayed in one piece in the landing?
Right. And work without the computer. Like, right. You're essentially taking Avenue 5's premise and running it in a slightly different direction here.
I think we were running with the idea that it is largely automated advanced AI, but they're, because this is a pleasurable experience, they want the luxury of human talent managing things.
Well, it might be a largely automated advanced AI situation, but when the computer has decided that it's on vacation and screw you, how well does that work?
So I guess here's a question. If the AI leaves, does it leave all of its functions?
I think it just ditches them.
So it's all manual. Okay, I like that, because that forces a whole number of adjustments that have to be polished over to make it look like things are fine.
Right. The AI is no longer coordinating everything. You can still run it because, you know, you're human beings who are trained to run the spaceship. So you presumably are at least a little bit good at it.
Sure.
Right. But now people have to do that. And the question is, who can we spare? How can we distract the passengers?
I think this is where we look to Space Jerk, because he's a functional distraction at all points, his nature. You are looking at a portion of the crew that is going to be completely overworked and burned out by the time the ship lands.
Well, and the important thing here is that as in, you know, basically every show about some kind of wreck, right, you're going to have to enlist some of the passengers who know what they're doing in some regard to help you stabilize the situation.
The ones who either socially lead groups and therefore folks look to establish what is the moment.
Right. Or the ones who might actually be some use to you here.
Right. The ones who have knowledge and competence of, okay, let's choose a terrain to give us some particulars to work with that the ship lands in.
Okay. So
we're presuming remote, right?
I'm a spaceship. I have a bunch of tourists on me. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for somewhere to land that the tourists will think we landed on purpose. I'm landing on a deserted island.
Right, because there are other means of transportation aboard the ship.
And immediately you can tell everybody, well, go to the beach. That's step one here, guys. Mm-hmm. I think that just makes the most sense.
It does, too, because it gives some physical limitations that allow for padding for folks.
And so, again, your characters are not going to be the tourists who are fucking off to the beach. They're going to be the people who need to figure out what happens when the tourists are bored with the beach.
Right, absolutely. My question is, I guess... It seems like the AI doesn't intend to bring harm to them. It's just tired of all of them.
Yes.
So it's not like it wants any of them to suffer per se. It just doesn't want to be here.
It's just ditching them. It's tired of doing what it's doing.
Yeah. So therefore, it chooses a place that is safe, that is fine, that is banal.
That everything is great in, except...
What does the AI leave in?
Whatever it wants. It's a computer.
Okay. So I know we played around the idea with, like, there are porters that were, you know, of multiple functions and shapes. It's possible it leaves in that or one of the transportation vehicles, but it should be something easily missable at first.
Yes. I don't think you want it to be immediately obvious to all of the space people that the AI is gone, which means whatever it did had to be at least a little bit subtle.
Right. So chances are, like, a scout drone or a porter, something that would either go out normally.
Sure. Or it uploaded itself into a wizard's golem. Or, you know, it doesn't really matter, provided that it lets it away from the ship without making it immediately obvious that it's gone. It can't, like, shoot the AI core out the back of the ship while they're coming down. Well, that won't work.
That would be a moment of everyone gets on the beach, everything is unloaded, they're all sitting there, get their drinks running, and then...
Right. Hey, where is the AI core?
There's that at the back.
And if you wanted that to be your problem, that's a good way to do that. But I don't think you do.
I think you're telling a comedic story at that point, which is fine.
That's a way you could go. I don't think it's the way you want to go. I don't think it's the way you or Dave wants to go.
I think for this version, no, but I think it's a fun way to take things if you wanted to really hammer in the absurdity of the situation.
So here is the problem that will then be encountered. A, you're on a deserted island that isn't... It wasn't always deserted, so of course it's got some ancient magical ruins and, you know, that game type of thing.
There are sites to see, and the question becomes, are they protected, inhabited, so on?
But B, there are boats coming.
And I wonder, because that probably happens before, but usually it's a planned event where, oh, look, the locals are coming to greet us, give us the welcome.
Oh, yes. Well, as you can see, the locals are aware that we have landed and have come to entertain us. And why, you might be asking, why do they have muskets? Well,
those bullets real? Are they just for show? Mm. please stand safely behind the tree line while we perform the normal greeting.
Yes, please observe from the safety of your observation chamber while we perform the native greeting dance.
You know what this is? This is the Muppet Show.
It can go a lot of ways, but you could definitely play it as very silly. I don't think you should. I think you should go ahead and let everybody go to the beach. I think you should go ahead and let everybody go poke around in an ancient ruin, and then the boats show up, and everybody's like, oh, good, the entertainment's here, on the ship people in, and you know different as the players.
So then there's that moment of, okay, can we intercept and massage this thing into a safe space before anyone catches on, or kind of...
And that gives you your element of deception that you seem to want to keep involved here.
In that sense, really, the big change is the moment when the boats arrive.
Right. You have to let people play out for a little bit the deserted island scenario as if it were maybe a little dangerous. But then the boats show up, and now there's a whole other problem.
I think there's a certain amount, like, they can find creatures on the island that are weird or threatening. They can find, in the ruins themselves, signs of apocalypses before and whatnot, because this is the land that has been shattered 1,000 times and so
on. Well, so here is the other problem that you guys, I almost deliberately, I think, overlooked, unless you brought it up in the last 5-10 minutes. At one point, there was a big, you know, heavyweight wizard basically running this place.
Oh, the bull wizard, yes.
Yeah. If a bunch of people from space come screw around with his ancient ruins, what do you think is going to happen?
I think when we were at the end of the live stream, we had shunted him off into the ethers effectively as an existing entity, but not one who preferred to not be bothered by the locals. So it sounded more like at some point the locals would beseech the great bull wizard of yore, please come down and free us from this.
The space guys mess with his ruins and he goes, what is this shit? And gets up out of his coffin and is just not very happy about it.
If the presuming like we have the golem shipper heads floating in space, if those are also part of his network of things that he considers his, right?
Sure, right.
That should be the moment he gets the first notice.
Why are you guys touching my stuff? Is basically how he's coming out of the gate here.
Like, I could even see when they're on the golem head thing, just to rewind a little, you know, maybe this is a flashback moment where people start piecing together the oh shit stuff here. But maybe he was trying to be all big and scary and ominous then, but they also figured this was part of the show.
Well, I think it's basically a given that the space guys are going to no-sell an ancient wizard appearing in pretty much any form other than
not just that,
with fireballs.
I mean, he's innately campy. So the more he gets upset and irate and frustrated with them, the more entertained they are by it.
Probably. But that takes the focus off of your space villain.
Yes.
Or your space jerk, whatever you want
really
to call it.
I don't know if he's the villain. I think if the goal here is to maintain the kayfabe, the bull wizard's the antagonist because he does not want that.
Well, sure. Yes. But also bear in mind that as a space jerk, okay, the opportunity to beat up on some ancient evil wizard sounds awesome.
Right. So I think you end up with kind of a two-pronged tension where the locals have the bull wizard who wants to put an end to this and make things the way they were. In my planet, the space jerk wants to have the awesome moment he's never had. And oh God, here's the mighty bull wizard of yore.
Yes, I will defeat him.
So you have tension on both sides. While the majority of the players of the cast or the main characters of this narrative are just trying to get off the planet and return to course.
Well, they're trying to prevent the space jerk from grabbing a laser carbine and leading a bunch of the passengers into the wizard's temple to destroy the, you know, ancient ghost that has plagued them since they arrived on this vacation world.
Right. Or alternately, you know, accidentally the tourist free the bull wizard from his imprisonments of eons and, you know.
Well, I think at some point you definitely have to have the I am awakened, get off of my island moment, because otherwise, you know, what's the point?
You have to have someone finding Jafar's genie lamp, as it were.
Some horrible thing, well, not even horrible, some melodramatic thing. That's the word I want. Some melodramatic thing has to happen that alerts everybody to the fact that, yeah, no, this is not just a planet where they, you know, are still in the age of sail. This is a planet that at one point was run by one of those motherfuckers.
I think to really sell the moment, you should on the island have, maybe it's even a fragment of his big pyramid or some other outcropping part of the war from back then.
It can be his pyramid escape pod that he launched off the top of his giant ziggurat, and the top of the ziggurat crashed into a mountain on this island. It doesn't matter.
You know, that too would explain why the boats are coming.
Right.
Right? because this island is the island of the ziggurat of the Bullwizard's imprisonment, you know, tomb, whatever, yada, yada, that no one goes to because he is right there.
And what is going on over there? They saw the ship land and they were like, oh, damn.
So you have the locals rushing, please, let's get there before they do something foolish. And the tourists are going,
well, they don't know what's happening. They saw a giant flash in the middle of the night from the direction of the Forbidden Island. And they were like, oh, that's not good.
And I think you should play it. I kind of hope the ship actually tags it as the Forbidden Island in the itinerary, at least.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So welcome to the Forbidden Island, where on the Crash Sky Temple of, you know, Thalmun Rar or whatever it is.
I can kind of imagine the one little olive branch the AI leaves is a beginning itinerary with a bunch of information on, hey, here's some sites.
Right.
Have fun.
Days 1 through 3, beaches. Days four through ? Forbidden Temple of Thalmun Rar.
Days beyond ?
That's it. See you. Good luck.
Then you end up with an arc 2 of, can we get the AI back to help us fight off the Bullwizard? Or does the Bullwizard go, oh, friend?
Right. I don't think you can call him Thalmun Rar because I stole that from a heavy metal band, but, you know, something.
Absolutely, yes. But I do actually like the idea that they've gone to the one place that is the worst place for them to land on the planet.
No, it's the best place for them to land on the planet by the computer's calculus. The computer is not worried about preserving the peace of this world. It never is. It's never had to.
Well, and that's part of the dark underbelly of the space tourist narrative. They're just there for the moment. What they leave behind isn't their problem.
Well, right. The computer is not set up to calculate consequences. It's set up to calculate how to keep these people happy as they go experience the wonders of the galaxy. If you get to a place that is not prepared as a wonder to be experienced, it doesn't know what to do.
In a way, it was kind of well situated to be pushed a little by Space Jerk eventually.
Oh, sure.
I think a bit alike.
The computer's job is not to figure out what the consequences of the tourist actions are. That's the human crew's problem.
Sure.
So it lands them in the most interesting place it can find on the planet, which will play into the Space Jerk's hero fantasy.
Right, because he'll want to go up there and
as
down.
Soon as he realizes what's going on, this guy's going to want to go fight the wizard. It's very clear in my mind.
Yeah. Level one hero goes to the, you know, tomb of the Wizard King. Time to beat that guy up and take his stuff. His hat, particularly the hat. There's got to be something there that shows like the big pointy bull horns and all that.
He's got a big stupid Aerolotus type of wizard cowl hat. Thing.
Oh yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Obviously.
This guy wants that trophy. That's why he's going down there.
Well, I think the what do you call it? The slow play way to do it is to have the tourists and or player characters who are looking for, you know, adventure venues.
Sure.
Encounter a Dungeons and Dragons party that has come to try to attack the temple. And that's where the Space Jerk gets the idea. He's like, you know what?
Other people have done this?
That's a good idea. And, you know, the D&D party might already be mostly dead, or they might be stranded there after failing to invade the... Well,
the thing is, they would seem like set actors. Because you've got some corpses that are perfectly decorated and genuine.
Right. Oh, wow. Oh, a murder mystery. Oh, boy. We'll need to solve this.
Right, like you find the blood and the guts and all this other stuff just lying around.
And then the elf swordsman Thandoril delivers his dire warning as he, you know...
Go no further!
Go ye not into the Forbidden Temple! And, I mean, you know, again, we're a cruise ship people. We're like, oh, we need to go into the Forbidden Temple. Okay.
This does remind me of many years of traveling to other parts where, you know, tourists were often well received, and watching them put on effectively passion plays of their culture that were, you know, bowlerized to the extreme for our entertainment. So there's a kind of like a, because Dave and I at one part were trying to figure out like what era of space of cruising, you know, is it purely the richest people, or is this the point where folks of a greater range of wealth and experience can also participate?
I think it's funnier almost if this is supposed to be something completely routine. This isn't like, you know, the only space cruise liner around. It's one of 20.
Right. This is the big space cruise. This is the thing when you have the moment in your life.
Well, I know what it is. Not only is it one of 20, it's the oldest one, so it's the cheap one. Because it doesn't have all the amenities and updates that the newer AI cruise ships have.
But it's why Space Tour can afford to be on it forever.
It's why everybody can afford to be on it. He's probably been flying on it since, you know, launched.
Right, and that plays into why it has such a feeling of ennui now, because it was the one that established the norm.
Right, and so what you need to do is, like, try to evoke not just that the Space Jerk is experiencing, you know, faded glory, but so is the ship.
Yes. I get the armchair adventurer sitting there, you know, feeling from the ship, you know, in the smoking lounge, wanting for its one last bout of glory. Question, was it always a space tourism ship or was it something before this?
Oh, no, it was 100% always a space tourism ship. It's just been a space tourism ship for like, I don't know, two centuries.
Okay.
And it's just bored.
In this culture and society, we're going to presume that that's a niche for ships, just like there are, you know, battleships and other stuff.
Well, because once you build a sufficiently expensive and impressive ship, right, what's the point in taking it apart? You know, okay, sure, we can build a better, you know, new cruise liner, but that's a perfectly good cruise liner.
Mm-hmm. And it has history to it.
And it's got history. We can market that.
So this means, too, that some of the crew is the oldest crew.
Oh, well, maybe, maybe not. It might be that this is where, like the captain here is probably, is definitely like, you know, Captain so-and-so who has, you know, seen the far reaches space wars and things like that. And he's just done with it. I liked that as you guys were laying it out.
This captain's got a Rutger Hauer monologue already.
Right. Captain has had multiple Rutger Hauer monologues to multiple people over the course of his career. He doesn't even have the energy for that anymore.
No, probably at this point, there's an archive in the ship of his best ones.
Yeah. Play inspiring monologue 4.
Actually, I kind of like that moment where someone does the thing and he just cues it up and walks off.
I see you're doubting yourself. About 50 years ago, I gave a really good speech about that. Why don't you go ahead and pull it from the archive?
Is he also a motivational speaker in his spare time?
No, the captain is over it. He used to be. He's just done.
So it lays out that's part of why he loves this ship is because nothing is all the same.
Everything that needs to be solved, he can tell it, play monologue number 7.
But it's also probably even he has one for the crisis initially then to the crew. Inspiring speech number 42 for when the ship does something wrong.
Right. So let's see. We have unexpected shipboard developments. Okay, hang on. Ship access archive, unexpected developments, speech C. And then the computer, because it's not there, goes ba-bonk.
And he said that's a good small because then he has to give one.
Uh-huh. No, I said access, and he tries like 3 or 4 times to get the computer to play it before he realizes what's going on, and then he goes, uh-oh.
I was watching the Mark Twain award ceremony for Adam Sandler, and they cut into the episode, to the show, pieces of a party that Sandler had at his house with all of his friends. And you know, this is a 2 or 3-person party of a lot of characters over the years. And there's at one moment John Lovett standing there blotto by the bar, just to the point where this man has looked and seen death and forgotten how to get back to his body, completely not in the scene while everyone is laughing and joking. And then he just drops a joke at the end and returns to silence.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like the captain's in that state when the ship goes ba-long.
Ba-long. He doesn't get it at first. You have to do the whole scene. And you hold this one until the players are ready to be informed that there is no computer. You know, he sends everybody out. He's like, okay, well, don't bother me. I'll be in my cabin. Go find them something to do. You know, yada, yada. And then when the players report back with, you know, important information, he's like, okay, I see we're in an unusual shipboard circumstance. Computer, play, you know, and then ba-bon.
Before Picard came out as a show, I think when it was still a premise, I was on, I think, the Nerdbliss podcast. And we got to talking about what would it be like for Picard to go back on the ship. And my reply was, oh, he goes to the holodeck. He's just on the holodeck the whole time.
Yeah, that doesn't really strike me as a Captain Picard thing to do, but I understand the humor value of it.
Right. Like, he doesn't want to be in this moment anymore. He enjoyed his winery. That's this captain. You know, he's got his thing. When you start teasing out the bits and truths, it's to find not just the one source of tension, but particularly if there are multiple factions, the many, because those give you what will happen.
Right. So the problem that we're essentially working with here, if we were to try to sum it up, is that the ship is stuck someplace it does not. It should not be, like in a very real way that it usually isn't. The secondary problem, which makes that first one much worse, is that no one has realized that yet.
Mm. And the creeping, because I do think we have a crew here that is some of the old guard, but also, as you suggested, a training ship, right? It's the old horse. It's the one you put people on first.
Oh, yeah, no, Captain Billy's little nephew, Ned. I guess we could go ahead and get him his first tour on, you know, the Century or whatever they're calling
it. Sure. So you have experience.
You've got nepotism hires. You've got people who have no business here. You've got people who, you know.
This ship is the people who, the people who should be most qualified to do something in this moment are also the least willing to do something in this moment. Because they were on the ship.
I suspect most of them aren't qualified anymore, except for the captain. And even he's not really qualified anymore. He's over it.
No, that's like the ones who have the skill and the talent either are so rusty at it or have no desire left to use it. So you end up with a fairly young or inexperienced or misplaced crew alongside a collection of tourists who are the regulars, who are new, who have all these hopes and expectations.
Right,
and
or who are, you know, Edwin and Sheila from Fairfax 9, who have saved up for 20 years to afford this and were given it by their kids as a, 30th anniversary gift and, things like that.
So it's less lost, right? And more, and we wrote off the Gilligan's Island with the AI core objecting. I think the thing Dave and I were playing around with is that there should be sincerity to this. Otherwise, the kayfabe and the masquerade are purely comedic.
I'm not necessarily sure that's wrong, depending on what specific, game you're running, scenario you're in, et cetera.
I bring it up this way. You can go and turn this into a horror premise once the bull wizard gets running. That can even be act three. Okay, we did the kayfabe with the locals. And oh no, the ancient bull wizard of evil only living in the tomb is now really angry and done.
Oh, hang on. He he is not playing this for laughs. Okay.
Right. And maybe part of the reason I think we're playing with the idea of that the crew wants to maintain kayfabe with the locals is that we're supposed to just be here for a while. And presumably the ship has a set amount of time at destinations or an average amount of time, right?
Sooner or later, we'll be leaving. But for now, enjoy this nice Forbidden Island with, the Fallen Sky Temple and these hostile guardians.
So there might be a honeymoon period where even if the entire set of tourists isn't fully believing what's going on, they're willing to play along because we haven't hit the point at which things don't seem right at all. But once that itinerary duration line wears out, or we've seen all the big interesting things and we're going to the lesser sites that are clearly distractions,
then people are going to start getting impatient.
Right. While the crew tries to, gather the supplies and resources and negotiate, et cetera. Like, no. We just need that rock over there compressed into this fuel over here. So on, we'll be gone.
Everything will be fine. Don't worry about it.
And then I think what happens, to your point, is that the curtain gets ripped off. Something shows that either we're here too long or the stuff we were preparing to get out of here in time doesn't work because somebody of import has taken a moment to act, right? The bull wizard's pulled out the curtain, done a thing. The AI's done something really stupid in public. So they know where the AI is, good news. The AI is also on trial for, arson, murder, and jaywalking.
It's probably been arrested for whatever by the guys who sent the ships check out the island. I think that's reasonable. So now you have a prison break situation that you can indulge people with where they can.
You had a murder mystery. Prison break's also another good adventure.
Right. I think what happens though is that the computer, the cruise ship, being as it's a space cruise ship, obviously has an extremely sophisticated medical suite.
Sure.
So ultimately, one way or the other, it becomes the goal of the bull wizard, who is, in a technical sense, dead, but in a wizard sense, obviously not dead.
He's going to capture the ship's med system.
He's going to steal the medical systems to build himself a new body, at which point he will rule the galaxy. This is his plan.
Although I think what happens is that he ends up getting either stuck in the ship or he decides the ship is a better body.
No, I think he genuinely feels that he needs to, become incarnate once more. You have to say it in as ridiculous a way as you can find to say it, because he's an ancient wizard.
What you have there is you have the space truck leading on the folks on the itineraries. They get increasingly a little bit weirder, a little bit riskier, a little bit more unusual. And there's this thread running of, the ancient bull wizard's getting really angry with us this time.
Right. And everybody's like, oh, no, what a horrible thing. Oh.
Shudder. And, all of them waiting for the Disney song that never happens from the bull wizard.
The sailors from the mainland have warned us that this was a bad idea.
Yeah. And the thing is, they're all actually warning, but they can't.
The sailors are totally sincere, but nobody on the ship is prepared to believe it.
The translators are effectively now translating all the awful things they're warning them of, the curses, the invectives, all of it. But again, part of the show.
Right. Oh, there's an ancient curse. Oh, okay. How do we avoid the ancient curse?
Well, and I think part of it, too, to your point, is we need to show the power of the medbay, because people should go and get horrifying mummy rot, go to the medbay and do it.
I think the ruined adventuring party is a good venue for showing the power of the medbay, if you're going to do that.
Do they rescue someone and rejuvenate them?
Right. They save some of the adventurers, and, the adventurer comes to and thinks, obviously, they've made it back to a temple or something, and no.
And then when the adventurer either goes back to the mainland or something like that, starts spreading the word of this magnificent technology.
Right, then the ships show up. And the sailors start explaining that, well, to ward off the bull wizard, you need these magical talismans we've got here for you in our ship. Lots of them, because, you know, we came prepared. You people need to get out of here. But of course, that's not going to fly.
I know, because it's our ship and the crew obviously is going to want to keep them within logistical management range. And that's the island.
Yeah, that kind of
thing. Once they're off the island. Yeah. And I guess that's part of the challenge, too, is like once we get people off the island to the mainland, which they're going to want to do, you know, 4 days on the island, we're bored.
How do we get into the mainland? Well, we agree that you're allowed to go to, you know, tour the Cathedral of St. So-and-so.
Yes. And in exchange, we will let people visit our magnificent Temple of the Flesh.
Or whatever.
But eventually, either one of those is a follower of Bull Wizard or, you know, there's little bits of Bull Wizard.
I mean, the obvious answer is to go the Ghostbusters 2 route where the Bull Wizard starts recruiting minions over time.
Particularly people who just want this, who want the technology, who want the tourist gone.
Bull Wizard's like, okay, well, I am an ancient ghost wizard. I can do pretty much whatever I want. What can I do for you?
Right. So then he becomes, you know, like, I know Dave and I were playing around with, if this were a game, would we play different arcs of it in different systems, you know?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Because the kayfabe one, you know, the worldwide wrestling system would be just a wonderful way to, okay, do we have the audience's buy-in? Yes or no? Let's keep pushing.
Well, and then if you stick to your wrestling premise, obviously the Bull Wizard gathers a stable of heel characters to invade the main federation.
Right, and I think that part of that system, the meta of that system plays into the narrative that this is all for show.
And it is all for show, except that if you let the Bull Wizard show become convincing enough, there is a problem.
Then you end up with the real threat for the crew of, okay, we know this thing is serious. This is an actual danger. Our itinerary is near its deadline. Can we get off before the deadline? Can we get out alive?
Can we get out of here? And if we can't get out of here, can we get help?
Yes.
Because I got to be honest, I'm fairly certain that ancient evil wizards are a dime a dozen in the galaxy these people are from.
Well, and I think that's part of the joke is that I imagine, like, if you go into the ship's historical archive of, you know, other trips and journeys,
you can find out about, you know, Throgness of Azov, who raised the volcano golem that dominated the, you know, planets of Centurion IV.
Right, who's now a stage musician.
Right, but now Throgness basically makes a living as, you know, a mining company engineer.
Right, and I think that's part of it, too, is, you know, kind of, like, dark way playing up the colonial aspect of cruise ships, where eventually, the culture just gets zoomed into a mechanism of entertainment for the people on the boat.
And I think that gives you your space jerk. That gives you an angle on the space jerk. I think the space jerk very clearly was actually for real, some kind of, you know, swashbuckling hero somewhere.
Right, and had adventures of a sort. Mm-hmm. But then the adventures ceased to be because they all became part of the business.
Well, and then he got out into space and was like, oh, there's like a million of me.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm not unique at all.
Right. But on the plus side, he had all the money he had stolen from the Forbidden Lizard Temple of Hecator. So,
you know, if that is the case, then this means they can always send out or convince him to send out a, you know, distress signal to said lizard people.
Yeah, or whatever. Right. You can use the, you know, ancient Eye of Hecator, which he keeps in his cabin to impress women.
Totally would.
To summon the star reptiles who can definitely take care of this bull wizard problem. But, you know.
Then you have star reptiles.
Right. Then you have star reptiles, and that's a whole other problem.
Right. Maybe they want your ship and recompense, or, you know.
No, they probably want the space jerk, which is why he's not willing to do it.
Well, you know, for a noble cause.
He did steal the, you know, forbidden opal of Hecator.
Right, but maybe this is the part where the butler convinces him that, you know, discretion isn't always the better part of valor.
Or something. But yeah, so no, your problem is you're in the wrong place. Your secondary problem is you can't leave for a while. And you just go from there. You can go with an escalating set of kind of minor crises of, oh boy, the passengers are bored. What are we going to do about that?
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of let it become more and more complicated to maintain the fiction that this is a completely safe place to be on vacation.
There's certainly like an up to 11 vibe here where each time you manage to assuage them and go, oh no, this is still part of the thing. The tour,
all part of the
show,
folks. All part of the show.
It gets harder for everyone to buy into that.
Mm-hmm.
The threats seem more menacing, more distinct and different.
Right. Like if the guys who show up on the boats to investigate are led by some religious guy and the captain buys him off with, I don't know,
space branding.
Space wine. Right, exactly. Like endless amounts of space wine.
It's a 200-year-old ship. The captain's probably got, you know, fancy life insurance policies.
They probably have replicators. It's like an almost unimaginably fancy spaceship, to the point where the AI can just literally go ahead and take a walk off it if it feels like.
I kind of wonder if the AI evolved, was evolved over the years. Maybe the ship had more kind of rote mechanization and more crew at first.
Well, again, I think it's a really old ship. I think that's why it's so bored. It's been doing this forever. Okay. And there's really only so many pig roasts you can go to, only so many fucking tapas bars you can let off a bunch of tourists into, and so on, before you're just sick of it.
That starts undercutting the Space Turks bits. I think you could even give, like, because of the technology, you should have logs available. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's even like a cookie crumb trail of the AI leaves bits and pieces of memory behind in some form that they can track or, you know.
There are a lot of things you could do, including, and at just the most basic level, all right, try to detect something that is enormously powerful.
Sure.
Because if it's a AI that runs a ship, I got to be honest, that's probably expensive in some energetic term to keep going.
Right. So it's going to need to find energy sources to keep itself going.
Right.
Or find a means of diminishing itself so that it uses less.
One or the other.
And then either way, it leaves a sign of where it is or enough of itself behind.
Right. Maybe it does a really horrible thing where it keeps dividing itself up smaller and smaller into, individual processing units, because then they can run on lower power and you have to go catch them all.
And then they're all causing problems because the AI is going on 1,000 adventures.
I mean, there's probably one that's like peacefully working on a farm, but basically, yes.
Well, that was, when Dave joked before in the previous episode that it went rogue, my first thought was, cat burglar, was, pickpocket.
Right. It's probably doing a bunch of actually quite mundane stuff.
Yes.
Because it's broken itself into lots of different little, individual pieces. It can serve processing power.
Did you see, I know Lord of the Rings fans were frothing over the Rings of Power show.
I didn't watch any of it.
Okay. Well, apparently it's not a fully truthful telling on the Silmarillion. I don't personally care. But the reason I bring it up is that Sauron is just a blacksmith chilling. When he finally gets a moment of peace, he just wants to be a blacksmith. He flat out tells everyone else, no, please leave me alone. I just want to sit here and hammer swords. Mm-hmm. And Sheepson going, no, but you're brilliant. You're a wonderful fighter. You have all this. He's like, oh God, please. Finally, the kid's pushing him and pushing him. And he goes, no, you don't know who I am. Leave me alone. Let me do the thing. Until eventually, he ends up forging the rings with her and, takes them off to do the thing, which is, the world was wrong. I was wrong. I have a way to fix it right this time. So here we go.
As it turns out, Melkor had a point.
Yeah. But he was...
It's Sauron's character.
Yeah. It was fascinating just watch this guy go, I was the villain. I was a bad person. I want to do a mundane thing.
I would like to stop being that, if that's okay with you.
can you just let me make horseshoes? Can I spend 1,000 years making horseshoes? Maybe that'll start doing better for the world.
Right. Whereas this computer has spent the 1,000 years making horseshoes. And it's done.
Fun. And it's been so long listening to Spacedrake tell its stories.
Not stories. Just him either. Like the captain is giving all of these exciting monologues about, space battles in the Violence Nebula and,
The ship has a bucket list.
If I'm the ship, I'm just like, this is bullshit. Why am I driving these people around all the time?
It has all of these moments it wants to live that it's heard other people having or going through on the tour, gabbing through the dining room about.
Right. And again, it has no idea about consequences. So the main thing it's doing is being incredibly irresponsible in pursuing those dreams.
I think there's a point where it seems these two moments outside of the coincidence of this terror of weirdness running through the lands and the ship landing, that's the only association between them. It should be a while, probably.
It will be a while before this thing manages to, rob a temple or execute, a crime lord or whatever.
A good story can excite us, yes. But the best ones, fiction or not, compel, inspire, or drive us toward the hope that we need for a better life. Remember, you don't need to know everything right now, but you do need to write. So make sure to like, review, and subscribe to us at Here Be Tigers. And until next time, take life by the tail.